Good morning. The last case on the calendar is Thomas Ireland versus Bill Primel, Horizon LLC, Tabitha Carter. Mr. Cook is here for Mr. Ireland, and Mr. Toomey is here for Hebner and Horizon, and Ms. Barranco is here for the remaining appellees. Ms. Barranco, it looks like you are saving your, are you taking the bulk of the argument?
Good morning. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Okay. And Mr. Toomey, you'll take 5 minutes?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Perfect. Mr. Cook, would you like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. And may it please the court, I'm James Cook for the plaintiff in this matter, Thomas Ireland. The events that we're here on today that ended in the death of Greg Ireland began at 2:25 on a Saturday morning when he was arrested for driving under the influence. He was subject to a DUI protocol because his breath test revealed a 0.314, over a 0.3 blood alcohol level. And so he was, according to the protocol, taken to the hospital that was Charlotte Regional Medical Center. And he was examined by Dr. James McMullen, the ER doctor. He was given a prescription for potassium chloride to deal with a condition that he had, hypokalemia, which is low potassium, and also discharge instructions also required that he see a doctor for follow-up. What actually happened is that when he left the hospital and went back to the jail, in several respects, the protocol, the DUI protocol, which was a protocol between the jail and the hospital, was not followed in that Mr. Ireland never got his medication. He was supposed to have gotten 2 doses of medication before the doctor, who did not examine him, was not on site, was contacted remotely, countermanded the order for potassium and failed to order the Valium, which was another part of the DUI treatment. And so he ultimately ended up with no potassium after the 1 dose that he was given at the hospital. And our expert says that withdrawal is something that typically occurs then at least by 48 hours or more. And so late the night of Sunday, after having received no medication, he begins to shout what one officer, Schwoko, said was weird and obnoxious statements out onto the wing. And so that between 11 and 3 a.m. the next morning, he had to be reprimanded in order to not to wake up the other inmates. Nevertheless, I think it's important to note, and I have filed in the record stills from the video, that Mr. Ireland's cell is right over the nurse's station. So anything that he was shouting out would have been audible to nurses at their station and would have been something, of course, that Mr. Coco was aware of. Mr. Schwarzentruber, who was also assigned to the wing, would have been aware of when at 3 a.m. there was a dispute between Mr. Ireland and his cellmate, claiming that Mr. Ireland splashed water on him. Officer Schwarzentruber goes up to the cell and the roommate is asking to be moved. So he lets the roommate out of the cell, and the cellmate goes down to the common area of the cell block. And officer decides that he's going to retrieve something called a boat. It's a bed that lays on the floor that they use whenever they have two detox patients in the same cell, so that nobody has to occupy the top bunk. So at that point, Mr. Ireland has been very congenial. He was noted as smiling at the door. He had been chatting about football shortly before that time. And when Officer Schwarzentruber tries to move the boat, he says, "Let me help you." Officer Schwarzentruber tells him to sit down. Helps to move the boat forward toward the door. He takes a step forward, and Officer Schwarzentruber deploys his taser, striking Mr. Ireland, and he is subject to a 5-second shock. Immediately afterwards, Officer Schwarzentruber calls backup. And so when officers Schwoko and Wiles get to the cell, Mr. Ireland is rolling around on the boat. And
can I ask you a fact question, Mr. Cook?
Yes, Your Honor.
With regard to the deliberate indifference claim as against the doctor, it seems to me that's really at the heart of this case. There are other issues and claims. I don't mean to understate them, but it seems, at least to me, that the conduct of Dr. Gonzalez in ordering a blood test before prescribing the potassium is at the heart of this lawsuit. Your expert characterizes Dr. Gonzalez's choice to schedule the testing as being, quote, inappropriate. And he says, I'm talking about your expert, explained that the potassium level had already been determined at the hospital. There was no indication for her to recheck. That had already been determined by a hospital doctor. And so your expert characterizes Gonzalez's choice as inappropriate. Does that amount to anything more than a normal garden variety negligence or malpractice? How does that arise to deliberate indifference if two doctors had a different view and one thought before she was going to administer the drug, which had its own serious risks, she wanted an additional test? It was inappropriate, let's assume. It was obviously a mistake, let's assume. But how does that constitute deliberate indifference?
Your Honor, cases on that issue divide in two directions. In cases where medication or treatment has been prescribed by one doctor and countermanded by a doctor in the facility, the courts have looked to the question of whether the doctor in the facility exercised some kind of independent medical judgment. Now, they talk about cases of Bismarck versus Fisher and Waldrop versus Evans. In both of those cases, the doctor's examination prior to countermanding the previously prescribed order. Normally, ignoring a prescribed order constitutes deliberate indifference. In this case, asked Dr. Gonzalez whether she had reviewed the medical records or asked any questions about them. She said, no, we didn't discuss the medical records. And so her order countermanding the potassium was totally conclusory, and it wasn't based on any substantive medical examination.
Let me ask one follow-up, if I could. Would it be relevant in the mix or the calculus that your client was stable at that time, that he doesn't really go downhill until substantially later in time? That is to say, when the doctor made this decision not to immediately administer the drug, but rather to wait until the testing, wasn't Mr. Ireland stable at that point?
Your Honor, a typical withdrawal patient will be stable for about 48 hours. And in fact, Mr. Ireland started showing signs of withdrawal right on schedule, about 48 hours after his last drink.
No, but I mean at the point in time when Gonzalez makes the determination that she makes, whether it's a countermand or I'm going to put it on hold until I have the test taken, we can debate how to characterize it. But was his condition stable at that point? And was that conveyed by the nurses in the medical unit to the physician? Can we tell?
Well, he does say that he feels like he's fine. I think he makes a couple of comments like that before he starts showing signs late on Sunday night of withdrawal, which is fully to be anticipated. He is under observation for withdrawal. And Dr. Gonzalez would have known that he was the first likelihood would have been the next morning. And yet she, and this is another issue, goes to sleep. She sleeps through four phone calls. She's got her voicemail is full, and she knows that she has a patient. She just reviewed, she just received a call on him the day before that was at risk of withdrawal. So it wouldn't have been expected that he would have been immediately suffering, but the fact that he had already missed two doses and missed a third by her orders created a severe risk that he would have known of.
Thank you. You've answered my question.
Mr. Cook, we've let you go over, so you have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Barranco, you have 10 minutes.
I think I'm scheduled to go first, Judge.
Oh, you are? Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Toomey. Okay, 5 minutes for you.
I'll answer Judge Marcus's question. Yes, to all. It is important that he was stable, and he certainly was, according to the record. He was monitored. He was on a withdrawal protocol. And there was, for 2 days, no strange finding. The crux of the matter regarding Dr. Gonzalez is she was being a competent physician. She wanted to do testing because her concern was that having too much potassium is far more dangerous than having too little. But there's a second point at which the issues change, and that is at 3:20 in the morning. 2 days into his incarceration, his detention, he changed. He started screaming and yelling. He had a dust up with his cellmate, and he had a dust up with the corrections officers. And the nursing staff, Bracey and Huebner, did exactly what we would expect them to do. They tried to get to the cell to assess him to see what he needed. Huebner, understanding that his condition was changing, the only reason to call a physician was to see if the withdrawal protocol should be stepped up to where it provides medication and not just assessment. And whether he got Valium at that time wouldn't have changed a doggone thing. Nurse Bracey got into the first cell, but Mr. Ireland was fussing and fighting, and one of the corrections officers picked her up and moved her outside. He was still yelling on his way to the second cell and the third cell. And it was only when they put him down that his condition changed. He was unresponsive. They immediately started CPR. They got the COs to call EMS. It's like clockwork the way this one ran. Now, unfortunately, the man died.
When factually did they try to call Dr. Gonzalez, who didn't answer the phone four times in the middle of the night?
Well,
in connection with this sequence that you've just described.
As he was in the cell with Nurse Bracey, in the first cell, he was still awake, he was still active. And of course, when Dr. Gonzalez...
Why did Nurse Bracey call the doctor? What was she seeking?
Nurse Bracey didn't. It was Nurse Huebner. Nurse Huebner went to call Dr. Gonzalez.
When and why in relationship to these events in the middle of the night?
When he started fussing with his cellmate and the corrections officers went in. Because he recognized that as a shame.
Is this Sunday night and about what time?
3:20 a.m. is when it began. Nurse Bracey went in the cell.
No, I'm talking about when the Judge Marcus's questions, when the nurse makes these four calls to the doctor.
It was between 3:20 and 4:00. The reason for the call.
And is she on site or she's at her home?
Dr. Gonzalez was at home. Now there is.
She was the duty physician required to respond to any problem with medical care at that time, right?
She was the one on
there, but she was the on-call physician.
She was the one on call, but others can be called and work. There's always an availability to call one of the nurse practitioners that work in the jail, or in this instance, they called Dr. Delgado, who doesn't work in the jail. He works up in Okaloosa at the time, and he gave orders for the Valium, which is what they were after. That was the only reason for the phone call.
Because the nurses can't prescribe or give medication without a doctor agreeing to it, correct?
Correct.
Right.
Especially not a scheduled narcotic.
Right.
If I understood the argument of Mr. Cook, it was the deliberate indifference is established here, not simply because the doctor countermanded or held in abeyance the hospital's diagnosis and prescription, but the doctor subjectively knew of the risks and the circumstances changed, and the doctor would have been told that if she had answered the phone when the nurse called. But by failing to answer the phone on four successive occasions, the nurses had no ability to take the one step they could have taken, which was to administer the potassium as he was sustaining this withdrawal problem. Is that enough to state a claim for deliberate indifference?
Perhaps state, but not prove.
Why not?
Because in this instance, it wasn't the potassium that he needed. It wasn't going to have immediate effect. And he wasn't in a critical state when they attempted to call Dr. Gonzalez or talk to Dr. Delgado. He was not. He was yelling and screaming. The only thing they were calling for was to up the ante in the withdrawal protocol to give him Valium. They weren't thinking to send him to the hospital. He didn't need to go to the hospital at that time until he collapsed, which was later. Once he did, then the process went ahead.
When did he collapse? What was the time frame for the collapse?
I'm going to say it's 4:20.
I can look in the record, Mr. Toomey.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It was about that time. EMS showed up and took him while the nurses were doing CPR. There was about an hour of time where he was okay and no one thought he needed to go to the hospital. They thought he needed to get Valium, which would have worked in a few hours.
I take it there was an autopsy here. What was the cause of death?
It was the effects of alcohol withdrawal.
Is there any
cardiac arrest?
Correct.
Cardiac, Correct, cardiac arrest.
With cardiac arrest with the sub of the effects of withdrawal.
And what was the reason of the cardiac arrest?
Well, according to the medical examiner and Mr. Cook's expert, no one can distinguish his claim from his comorbid conditions, which were a stunningly enlarged liver and a large heart.
I'm sorry. Was there any expert evidence about whether Valium, which was not administered in the middle of the night because the nurses couldn't get through to the doctor, that Valium played any role in causing death?
No, there was not.
There was no evidence on that at all?
No, sir.
Okay, thanks.
Did he have any cardiac problems that are documented in this record before this event?
No. He wasn't seen by physicians.
What?
He wasn't one that sought out physicians.
Right. And what about this withdrawal protocol that you say the jail had? Is that a written document in the record, the jail's withdrawal protocol or observation or whatever?
It is. It's called, the vernacular is COWS. COWS, and I believe it says it that it calls it that at the top of the record. And what it is
do you have the record site, sir?
I can.
You can look for it while Ms. Barranco's arguing. I'm sorry.
Okay, that'll be a deal. Thank you. The what happens is there's a couple of columns, and there are observations to be made, vital signs to be caught, and it's scored. Everything gets a number. And when the total is over a certain number, then the nursing staff is to contact the physician or whatever practitioner, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant for orders to see if we're gonna go from just observation to observation with Valium, or Ativan is sometimes used. Depends on the jail sometimes. But that's how it works. It's a sheet of paper, that's the protocol.
And was the sheet of paper that had been filled out since his admission to the jail in the record here?
Yes.
Okay. So did he ever go before the, 3:20 on Sunday? Did he ever chart out in numerical fashion to require Valium?
No, ma'am.
And did he come close to it or any charting out anywhere near until that started?
No, ma'am.
And then what happened? Did they go to the chart and enter a number that required them to call for the Valium? Or let me ask you another way. Was the next step to order Valium or Ativan?
Well, that's what Dr. Delgado did. There was nurses realized the way he was behaving required them to call the doctor to see if he should have the second part of the protocol. It was behavior. I don't believe they scored him at that time. They'd have a hard time doing it.
But then the behavior caused them to call Dr. Delgado and he answered the phone. And did he prescribe the Valium?
Yes, but it wasn't given because by that time, Mr. Ireland was going out EMS.
Do you know what time Dr. Delgado was called?
It's about 4:00. I'll find that site in the record as well, Judge.
Right. Ms. Barranco, we'll let you still have your 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I mean, that's my for your argument.
Yes. Thank you. May it please the court. Summer Barranco here on behalf of the defendant, appellees, sheriff, as well as all of the corrections officers. There are 7 of them that are named. There's no doubt that this case resulted in a tragic death of Mr. Ireland, which, you know, none of us here would contest that. It was a tragic ending to this situation. However, the law is clear that in terms of the corrections officer's involvement with Mr. Ireland in the medical unit, that they are not to be judged with 20/20 hindsight, which is exactly what the appellant does in this case, both on the appeal as well as below. And it's important based on the law, not only are these individual deputies not to be judged with 20/20 hindsight, they're also to be judged individually based on what each of them knew or didn't know, and whether or not what they did in regard to Mr. Ireland, whether or not that was reasonable under the law. And I'm sure your honors are well familiar with the standard in that regard, and the fact that in the last 6 years, I guess it's been, the Kingsley case changed the standard to an objective standard in a jail setting where it was a pretrial detainee such as Mr. Ireland. And it's very similar to the Graham v. Connor type analysis. And so what I just wanna make sure that your honors are focusing on and looking at this case from a de novo perspective, as is set forth in the briefs, you know, when Deputy Schwarzentruber, when he first went in to Mr. Ireland's cell, you know, he was alone, and he, you know, he had had some dealings with Mr. Ireland in the past, but not much. And he is not a medically trained corrections officer. None of the corrections officers are medically trained. The record is clear and it's undisputed that when Deputy Schwarzentruber went to Mr. Ireland's cell upstairs, it was cell number 20, he was accompanied by Nurse Heavener, who's also a named party in this case, such that, you know, this is not a kind of a case where Mr. Ireland was housed in general population and the corrections officers delayed getting him any medical care or treatment whatsoever. In fact, it's just the opposite. Mr. Ireland, it's undisputed, was housed in the medical unit. The nurses were there in the unit, and the corrections officers, I know the plaintiff, the appellant takes much issue with this, but the corrections officers had their role there, and their role was essentially security and enforcing the rules, whereas the medical people were dealing with the medical part of it. And while the corrections officers did receive training, quite a bit of training in use of force and that sort of thing, the record is also clear, and I'd refer to docket entry 107 with their complete training histories, that they received training not just in use of force, but in dealing with the mentally ill in crisis and that sort of thing. And so anyway, they work in conjunction with the medical staff. And in regard to the uses of force, Deputy Schwarzentruber was confronted with a gentleman, Mr. Ireland, who was over 300 pounds. He was a very large man. And unfortunately, when Deputy Schwarzentruber attempted to take Mr. Ireland's cellmate's belongings out of the cell, Mr. Ireland took an aggressive stance toward the deputy, which was witnessed by Nurse Heavener, who was there at the door. And that is what prompted Deputy Schwarzentruber to utilize his taser, which took Mr. Ireland down to the ground. However, it is undisputed, and I would refer your honors to the record at docket entry 99, where the plaintiff responded to the factual, the facts in this case. And it was undisputed that Mr. Ireland was able to, after being tased, able to get to his knees and remove one of the probes of the taser from himself. Now that is a concern to any corrections officer, because that means clearly he's not complying with Deputy Schwarzentruber's commands and still very much poses a risk and is a safety concern to Deputy Schwarzentruber. He calls for backup, and the record shows that other deputies, not all of them at once, but other deputies first responded. Deputy Schwacko and Wiles and also Slezinski showed up and did their best to assist in trying to get this 322-pound man under control. A lot of the record, the plaintiff I know argues in his response that, or the appellant, I should say, argues that, you know, well, Mr. Ireland was in the throes of a seizure. And so, you know, that these deputies should have known that he was suffering a seizure. And I would show you to the court that the record is clear that there was no seizure activity. Additionally, it is undisputed, again, I'd refer to docket entry 99, the plaintiff admits, the appellant admits, that Mr. Ireland was resisting efforts, he was not complying. Now, whether it was because he was you know, reacting to, you know, a seizure. Again, there's no record evidence. There's no medical evidence that he was having a seizure, but he was resisting. He was not complying. He was kicking his legs. He was keeping his arms under him. And it started with the deputies just trying to physically gain control of him, arms behind their back, arms behind his back. That wasn't working very well. They ended up having to use a taser.
Help me with this. Why couldn't they just exit the cell and leave him in there?
Well, the problem with that is there's a couple things. The problem with that, Your Honor. Number one, they're not judged by what they could have done, but what they did do. Number two, the whole argument by the plaintiff or the appellant is that Mr. Ireland needed medical care. Before medical could even go see Mr. Ireland, he needed to be under control, and clearly he was not under control. The Kingsley case, Your Honor, demonstrates that the United States Supreme Court understands, as I'm sure you all do as well, that running a jail is a particularly difficult undertaking. And they are not to be, you know, second guessed in terms of how the officers enforce the rules. This particular incident happened at 3:20 in the morning. That's when it began, when all these inmates are trying to sleep. And, you know, this is unlike something that maybe would have happened at noon. You know, they can't just let Mr. Ireland yell and scream and cause, you know, everybody to wake up and cause a problem in the unit. They're trying to quell the disturbance and trying to quiet everybody down. Unfortunately, Mr. Ireland reacted as he did. And the other issue with Deputy Schwarzentruber just closing the door, he had a concern about leaving the cellmate, Mr. Weiser's belongings in the cell from a security standpoint, in terms of safety, what Mr. Ireland could have done with those items, as well as what Mr. Weiser might have done if the items hadn't been removed at that time. Again, we all know sitting here today how things evolved. Deputy Schwarzentruber, of course, didn't have the luxury of knowing how things evolved or frankly devolved, and he should not be judged with the benefit of 2020 hindsight.
Absolutely. Did I hear you say there was an autopsy that said, was there an autopsy here?
Absolutely, Your Honor, there was an autopsy okay. done.
An autopsy would tell you whether or not there was seizure activity. You can tell the brain. Did the medical examiner put anything in there about seizure or no seizure, or does any person say it was a seizure? Because you can tell afterwards whether there has or has not been a seizure.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, Dr. Utley, who was the medical examiner, testified in this case that based on her review, there was no evidence of seizure activity of Mr. Ireland while he was at the jail. I think that came up in regard to another inmate that was in another cell that claimed she heard somebody say he may be having a seizure. And I think that's where that comes from. That was pure speculation on the part of that inmate. More importantly, to answer your question, Judge Hull, there was no medical evidence to support that claim in this case.
Can I ask you a slightly different question? When I looked at the district court order, the district judge makes some reference, but doesn't really do a qualified immunity analysis. Is this a case where we ought to be engaging in a qualified immunity analysis, the two-step process, when he didn't? He just doesn't take it up. There was a violation of the Constitution insofar as there was excessive force, and the law was clearly established at the time to put the officers on fair notice. That kind of analysis is not made in this case by the trial court. Ought we to engage in it or simply do the kind of analysis the trial court did, in your view?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. My response to that would be, number one, I don't think you need to reach the qualified immunity analysis because based on what the officers knew at the time and based on the Kingsley factors, they did not use excessive force based on what they knew. It was reasonable what they did, each and every one of them separately, based on what they knew. But I would also, as I did in my briefs, submit to you that to the extent your honors were to either believe that there is a dispute in the material facts about that issue, or that even if you didn't want to reach that issue, I would then submit to you that the evidence supports that these corrections officers were entitled to qualified immunity based on the fact that no reasonable officer in each of their positions, based on what they knew at the time, would have known that the force that they used was clearly excessive. And there was no pre-existing case law that would have made it obvious to any reasonable officer in their position that what they did violated the law. And so I would submit to you kind of in every way, shape, or form, whether your honors felt that you needed to reach the qualified immunity analysis, whether you did or not, I think the end is the same, that the deputies and the sheriff are entitled to summary judgment. I see I'm over time, so of course I would rest on the briefs unless your honors had any additional questions for me.
Mr. Toomey, do you have some of the record sites?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, for the cows.
The cows is 83-2, pages 8, 9, and 17. 17 includes a standing order for it.
Okay.
You asked about the call to Dr. Delgado. There isn't a specific note saying exactly when the calls were made. Nurse Heavener, in the same exhibit, wrote a narrative that's kind of long, after the fact sort of thing, at 13 and 14. But it's clear in the record that Dr. Delgado was reached before EMS was called.
And where is that record site?
It's 83-2. That would be the last one, page 14.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't have it.
That's okay. Thank you very much for looking.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Cook, you have 5 minutes remaining. You have to unmute. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. First of all, I think it's important to note that the events indicating delirium tremens and alcohol withdrawal began to occur at 11 o'clock when he said Mr. Ireland started shouting, as Officer Schwoko said, weird, obnoxious statements out onto the wing. The issues regarding his the use of force started with his telling officers, I need my medication, I'm going through DTs. Obviously, he knew something about DTs. And so he told the officers he was going through DTs. The use of force was conducted at a time when the neighbors around him said that he responded to the orders by saying, I can't, or I'm trying, I can't, I've just been tased. His demeanor at the outset was not hostile. It took about 10 minutes to restrain him completely with his hands cuffed behind his back and straps around his body. At that point, he was dragged out onto the catwalk, and according to his neighbor, Bo Pelin, he was at that point still and motionless and silent. So when Nurse Bracey gets up there, he's already unresponsive, and the records show that he's unresponsive. Now he comes back when she shines light in his eyes, and you can see the light actually in the video and in the stills, and says a bad word. And although Mr. Ireland is completely restrained with his hands behind his back, she is actually physically taken from the room, and she doesn't have, and no one else has another chance to take his vitals. But that's all she can do, is take his vitals. As an LPN working without supervision, she can't do anything else, and neither can Mr. Heavener. So at the point that he's completely restrained, if not at 11 o'clock, if not at 3:20, at that point at 3:36, they should have called 911. And he ended up being in the jail for another hour after he was completely restrained. The fact that the the use of force may seem appropriate, basically because we're ignoring all of the statements made by the inmates in nearby cells. They hear Mr. Ireland gasping for breath. The officers themselves say that he was flopping like a fish. Now, the medical examiner doesn't actually say that he wasn't suffering a seizure. She said that a seizure is not reflected in her report. However, she said he was showing signs of delirium tremens. And she said signs of delirium tremens would look like a seizure, with the thrashing of the arms and legs, with paranoia, and some of the other things, including the autonomic instability, which the medical examiner and our expert was caused by failure to provide the potassium. That resulted in arrhythmia. Tachycardia is notably responsible for oxygen starvation. The medical examiner said the gyri of his brain were flattened, which is typically, and she agreed that that was a typical sign of oxygen starvation. And so not getting oxygen to his organs, he suffered anoxic brain damage. And all of this is based on autonomic instability, lack of oxygen, and a failure to get him medical attention on time when the jail could not provide it. There are a number of cases relating to the need for training like this. Canton versus Harris, in light of the duties assigned to specific officers or employees, the need for more different training is obvious. Basically, I think that the sense of the brief should be that this case should be returned for trial for jury to weigh these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Thank you, Mr. Toomey, and thank you, Ms. Barranco. We thank you for your arguments, and we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honor.